The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to this podcast. This is episode... Welcome to this podcast. This is season 4, episode 13. It says it right on the piece of paper in front of me. I even wrote it that way so I wouldn't mess it up this week. But there you go. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jonathan Kula in Mississauga, Ontario.
Hello, party people!
And we're also joined by Jaime Lopez... Man, wow. We're also joined by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
He's still talking to me. That's good. All right.
From the frosty north.
Yeah, speaking of the frosty. So last week, let's do some fact check. Last week, Jonathan said that Jaime could have everything south of the 49th parallel. And I just wanted to point out that Seattle is actually north of Toronto and therefore north of the 49th parallel as well. So technically, Toronto, well, no, I guess they're south, sorry, they're south of the 49th parallel. That's the line that goes from across... from like Winnipeg to Vancouver-ish,
yeah,
right? And divides Canada and the United States in, on just in a straight line. But Toronto, we dipped down because we wanted to hang on to the lakes or whatever. War of 1812, look it up. And then, yeah, so Toronto is actually, so if you look at the latitude, which one's the
longitude is east-west.
Latitude. Okay, latitude then, right? Is what I want. Of Seattle is 47 degrees and Toronto is 43 degrees. So we're actually lower than 49th parallel would be at the 49th degree. If you did a like arc around the world, if you believe in the, you know, the round world and the whole flat earth society thing, whatever, then you're on your own. And the other piece of follow-up I have here, that Gale, or G-A-A-L, Gale Dornick, apparently, it was a character in the first part of the Foundation book and was a psychohistorian working with Harry Seldon in Trantor, and played by Lou Lubell, but she was only in the first, she was very in a very short part of the first book, but she's obviously survives to the first and second episode, I believe, right? So, because it was a big question, like, what happened to her in the story, because I saw a blog post about that, and like, what happened to her? She just sort of stopped showing up, because the third episode of Foundation, which we saw last week, they're
spoiler,
well established. I'm not going too far. They're well established on where are they going again?
Oh, the
Terminus,
yeah, the ice
Terminus,
planet, yeah.
Yeah, so there's some sort of weirdness going on. It's actually filmed in Iceland. It looks really cool. Anywho, all right, let's move on to the headlines. And, you know, Jonathan's up first, as usual, with the House of Dragons.
Yeah, we got a more robust look at House of Dragons. We had a teaser trailer drop this week. We had seen some stills so far that had sort of seen some of the characters. This was our first sort of actual look at, you know, things moving around. It wasn't a lot of taste. It really just sort of gave you a sense of the sets and the characters, a little bit of sense of foreboding. They set the scene. Obviously, it's 200 years before the events of Game of Thrones. This is, of course, the prequel to the HBO classic series. I thought it was an interesting trailer. We get to see Matt Smith with his blonde long locks, which is an unusual look. You're so used to seeing him with his dark hair, so that's interesting. And yeah, just a little taste of that world, although it really doesn't sort of spell out the stakes or what's going on there. We just obviously know that this is about the Targaryens, the dynasty that relied on dragons to rule the Seven Kingdoms. Hope it ends better than the last one. So I think there's a little trepidation on the behalf of fans. And also I think it's funny how quickly we forget. I mean, Game of Thrones was the biggest collective sort of television live experience in a long time. I'm curious to see if this series can rekindle that. Did you guys watch?
No, I haven't seen this one yet, no.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see.
Targaryens, right?
Sorry. Yeah. It's did they say it was like a few hundred years prior to Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah, 200 years is what it says in the trailer.
Yes. It's kind of interesting to see, you know, that Game of Thrones kind of style, the cinematography. We get a look at a little bit of a different Iron Throne. And this will be the first time in live action, I think, that we'll see the Targaryens flying their flag and etc. Right? Like, it's always mentioned in Game of Thrones, but they're a fallen house, and you know, their sigil is shown, but it's not like you get to see people, you know, wearing the armor, flying the flag and stuff. So it's going to be something a little different, I think. So there's that angle to go into it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's lots of ground to cover there. I'm always a little trepidatious about prequels, given some past experiences. I think they'll do a good job. Obviously, you know, they've really been mindful. They did try a few different angles on what they would do for a next Game of Thrones experience. And the fact that they chose this one, he says that they must have seen the potential. I don't know. I always have a real struggle with prequels because, well, in one case, we kind of know how this ends. We know that by 200 years later, the Targaryen dynasty has fallen. We know that, you know, the dragons have gone by the wayside. So, like so many prequels, it sort of gives you a sense of what kind of beats you might hit. The flip side of that is it was such an amazingly imaginatively depicted world on the television program that there's hope that even if it's a little predictable, it'll be really interesting to watch. The drama is usually really good. The acting quality is very high. So even if it's a little bit prescriptive, maybe the quality will just be high enough to sort of push you past that. All right. Next up, we have some news from Variety.com that Disney Plus is going to do a spin-off from WandaVision focusing on the character of Agatha Harkness, played by Catherine Hahn. Interesting news from today. Apparently, WandaVision head writer Jack Schaefer is going to be the writer and executive producer. And of course, Catherine Hahn will be back in the titular role. If they don't call it Agatha all along, I think that's a missed opportunity. But I wonder about this kind of stuff. So obviously, you know, they go into these shows with the best of intentions. They start with characters that are established that you know, Wanda and Vision, Bucky and the Falcon. I am interested to see if this is the sort of start of the next trend. You know, if there's breakout characters from some of these shows, are we going to see, you know, a Captain Carter series? Are we going to see, you know, series like this one? And now that they've done this, I think it's really interesting to see if we start to see spinoffs of spinoffs of spinoffs.
Yeah. I mean, people definitely love what the actress did. People found the character, I think, pretty interesting for at least most of the run. I think there were some quibbles on the like typical Marvel ending that it sort of has at one point, but I kind of wonder where they're going to go with this. I mean, it's, you know, let's not forget that Loki wasn't exactly a hero in general, but the specific version of Loki we got is the hasn't learned how to not be a bad person character. So it is conceivable that they could take a villain and make something around it. And there is sort of the you know, if you take the Broadway play Wicked, which is the Wizard of Oz, but told from the Wicked Witch of the West's perspective, they could go that route with it and do something a little unorthodox.
By the way, tangent here. Did you guys see the post about Sarah Silverman taking exception with Catherine Hahn playing Joan Rivers in an upcoming biopic?
No.
I can fill in the deets.
Yeah, apparently, I haven't got all the details. I saw it today earlier. I read a bit of it. It was just a very short article, but Sarah Silverman's, you know, kind of points out that they've had characters like Joan Rivers was clearly Jewish, and Sarah Silverman's obviously very, very pro that way. And Catherine Hahn isn't, right? And she's like, Her question is about why, like, she questions why these actresses, like Catherine Hahn, obviously on the success of WandaVision and her Emmy, was booked to play Joan Rivers in this story. And I'm sure she'll do a great job, but Sarah Silverman's point is that, you know, they keep putting non-Jewish actresses to portray Jewish women, and they do the whole sort of, you know, the Bronx sort of twang that the New York sort of style twang to their voices. A case in point is Marvelous Miss Maisel. The actress there is not Jewish either, right? So anyway, so, you know, Sarah Silverman has an interesting point there. It's kind of a different kind of whitewashing, you know, if you think about it. Thoughts?
I think this comes back to the same stuff that we've talked about before, which is, you know, where do you draw the line on all these things? You know, can somebody who's not blind play somebody who's blind? Can somebody who's right. not hearing impaired play somebody who's not hearing impaired? Somebody with a learning disability, like where do you draw the line? Obviously, yes, I think there's an authenticity level, and there certainly are high enough caliber performers that you can draw from a pool. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely tricky territory. You know, you could say, well, you know, so by Sarah Silverman's argument, does that mean that only a Jewish woman should be able to play a Jewish woman in a...
No, it's not black and white. The point is that they keep casting these women in roles, like these non-Jewish women in roles playing very Jewish people, right? Like people who are known for she calls it Jew face in the story, right? Mm, so, you know, like that, you know, Sarah Silverman doesn't mince words, right?
But, no, of course.
Yeah. You know, and we've had this before. We had Scarlett Johansson playing an Oriental character. And, you know, that just seemed odd. I think that movie kind of died a horrible death too, right? I can't remember the name of it, but... Ghost in the Shell. Yeah, and there's been other cases like that where you get people, you know, it's not... We're not talking about brown face or black face here, but we're kind of talking about that in a manner of speaking, right? You know?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I don't know. I struggle with that one for sure on... where the lines are anymore. Obviously, there are plenty of people who can play the parts that are appropriate, that have, you know, a background. I mean, I think we've come a long way from, you know, the 1940s and 50s movies where we had, you know, white actors playing incredibly bad Asian stereotypes and things like that.
Right,
we've come, you know, even further from, you know, Amos and Andy and things like that. I guess... I appreciate Sarah's point that there's an opportunity that can be given to Jewish actresses to play those roles. I just struggle with where that line is anymore. If there's an obligation or if that should be a consideration, that's a really tricky one.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be curious from your perspective. Well, both of you, I suppose. I mean, I'm the token white guy on this panel, so I'm curious as to whether or not, you know, you feel like there's a need or a, like, would you be offended if someone who was not Latino was playing Latino? If someone who was, you know, where's the line? Is somebody pretending to be from Texas? Is that okay? Can they affect a Boston accent? Can they affect a Texas accent? Like,
well,
we just gave
an Emmy to Kate Winslet, right?
Yeah, for doing a Pennsylvania accent.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, that's a good question, and it's so hard to like give my thoughts on it without making it feel like it's minority versus minority. But I think there's definitely been a lot less representation for some minorities over mm-hmm. others. And I don't know, and I fully understand Sarah Silverman's point, and I'm not, you know, saying that there shouldn't be maybe more representation of Jewish actors playing Jewish characters. I also, from my perspective, I'm like, yeah, that's not really like a huge problem. There definitely has been representation of Jewish actors and characters. It's not as if it's like, oh, you're Hispanic, great, you play the janitor or the maid, right? Like they're not necessarily pigeonholed into those roles. So that's not to say that there isn't a struggle that I think maybe Sarah Silverman's getting at. I can't understand because I'm not in that category. It's just hard from this perspective, right? And again, not trying to turn it into minority war kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to be honest with you, like I never had a problem with the guy in Johnny Five, right? The Short Circuit, until you pointed out to me that he wasn't actually, you know, an Indian dude, right?
Yeah, right.
So yeah, that there's that, right? And but that's like you said, that's sort of something we've hopefully come out of. But you know, one of my favorite movies is Breakfast at Tiffany's, right? You know, because of the person I live with. But you know, and I love Mickey Rooney, but he plays a very incorrect or a very, you know, questionable character in that movie, right?
Yeah, 100%.
He plays the neighbor, right? And yeah. And just it's an awful portrayal. I mean, he's a great portrayal, very funny, comedic, you know, cartoonish character, but it does nothing to support that those persons, right?
No.
Anyway, I just thought I'd bring it up because it was interesting, because since you were talking about Catherine Hahn anyway, and she sort of got, you know, roped into this discussion. And again, like Sarah Silverman has nothing wrong with the actual casting of, or the choice of casting. Just she questions how the casting is done.
Yeah.
Right. So
well, anyway. Interesting to see if it has ramifications, though, that kind of raising that thought line.
Yeah. 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 Anyway, that was a Huffington Post story, by the way, for those of you driving at home or transporting at home. What's next?
And the other thing I've got here is about a bit of casting news we got today. So Jake Gyllenhaal is going to be starring in a superhero film called Prophet. And Prophet is based on a 1990s comic book property created by Rob Liefeld's company. And I don't know if, I assume, Tim, you haven't. I don't know, Jaime, if you've read Prophet. Prophet was sort of a little bit derivative of Captain America. It was centering around this guy who basically gets these superhuman powers back during the war, and then he sort of has these long stretches of life, and he's this sort of super soldier type character. The sort of claim to fame of that comic was that there was a sort of a rising star artist named Stephen Platt who was drawing that. He did a short run on Moon Knight for Marvel that got a lot of attention, and then he jumped over to work with Liefeld on that book, and there was just a lot of interest in his art style. Very interesting, very dynamic, you know, huge swollen muscles, very 1990s. And it's very interesting that this is moving forward as a film project, just because it is so far past its initial wave of interest. I like Jake Gyllenhaal. I think he's good. I think this has the potential to be something good. I wonder if it will be able to rise above the crowd in a very crowded field of superhero flicks, and whether or not it's gonna resonate in any way. And I don't know how they capture the sort of quality that the art style and that era of comic storytelling had. I think if they can find a way to capture that, it could be very interesting, just because it was that sort of, you know, huge guns, huge muscles, kind of, you know, swollen era of comic books in the 1990s. I wonder if there's going to be sort of an ability to capture that feel within the book or within the movie. I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this one. Jaime, did you ever read Prophet?
I didn't, but I just Google searched to see some images, and I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. I kind of remember seeing this character on the shelf. Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with the character. I am kind of wondering, because this is Rob Liefeld, will they not show the character's feet on screen? Look at Google image search and tell me what this person's feet look like. Man. Oof. Yeah, that's like a weird thing where Rob Liefeld didn't know or did not like, I'm not sure which.
He hated drawing them. He hated drawing feet.
And yeah. So he usually has the feet like behind something in a scene.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. It became a huge running gag that, you know, no matter what was happening in a scene, you were rarely going to see a character's feet.
Wow. Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Again, it was an interesting book, and it did have a bit of a revival in the 2000s. The Image did a really interesting thing at one point where they basically picked up a bunch of their series that had ended in the 90s and just sort of started from the next issue, but like 10 years later, like where would they have left off, and put some interesting creative teams on them. Prophet was one of those. And I read those at the time. It wasn't bad, but I really do wonder whether or not this is going to have any legs.
It does raise a question, because I mean, like, you know, like I had no idea who Judge Dredd was, right?
Hmm.
You know, until Sylvester Stallone did a movie, right? And, you know, of course you knew who he was and all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, they did the Dredd movie again. And I think that might have had a little bit of chance to sort of survive in the theaters because Stallone had done the original movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of wonder, like these, like the other one is Spawn, right? That's another character that, you know, and the new one, the Spider Guy one, that's out right now with, what's his name? The guy from that movie, Tom Hardy.
Venom, yes.
Venom, thank you. Yeah, like I had no idea who Venom was. I mean, like I've been, you know, a Spider-Man fan since I was a kid. You know, people know Spider-Man, they know Batman, they know, you know, they know Bruce Wayne, they know Superman, they know those characters, right? These outlier guys, like even Aquaman could be argued, most people don't even know who Aquaman is, right? I would think, right?
Well, it's funny because there is a generation gap there that you really hit on there, which is to say probably people your age or maybe even my age and older would know who Aquaman is because of his sort of presence in the zeitgeist.
Whereas Saturday morning cartoons, that's the only way I knew
him. Sure,
right?
But then I think the flip is opposite for maybe people Jaime's age where Aquaman doesn't resonate quite as much as Venom does. Venom's been around for 25 or 30 years and has been a major Spider-Man
villain.
But
that's if you're a comic book reader, right? Like,
he had a turn in Spider-Man 3 in the movie theater too, and the cartoon series and the video games. Like the thing is, it's not one-dimensional anymore, right? Like it's sort of out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, like this character you're talking about in Prophet, I mean, like, or even Preacher. I mean, I had no idea who Preacher was until AMC did a show on it, right? So, you know, so, and the success of these shows, I mean, do they, how much of a chance do they have? I mean, obviously, you know, even Daredevil, you know, when Affleck did it was kind of an outlier character, you know, and, but, you know, but then the Netflix show put it back on the map, right? And Arrow is same thing, right? Like, you know, I used to always get mixed up between DC and Marvel. With the Green Arrow and the Green Lantern, and the, you know, they each had a guy or a girl who did the same sort of thing on the other universe, and but there wasn't the same character. And
well, and the Flash and the Quicksilver, like guys who can run fast. Like, that's the problem is a lot of comic books at times can be a bit derivative. As we just talked about that with Prophet, right? Prophet's a little derivative of Captain America. Obviously, there are a lot of overlaps. Yeah. Daredevil has some pays some dues to Batman. You know, like there's a lot of overlaps, right?
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, like even the Green Hornet, I knew who the Green Hornet was because they had a TV show, right? But I mean, at the time, I wonder how many people really knew, had even heard of Green Hornet. It was a spinoff from Batman, the 66 Batman series, right?
I think that was an overlap. I think they were running concurrently.
Yeah, no, I mean, they were on at the same time. In fact, they even had crossover. They had a crossover
episode. They did
episode,
have a crossover,
yeah. Yeah, so, but I mean, you know, but they were the same company, same, you know, whatever was behind it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was a successful formula. A guy with a partner in a car. Let's put another guy with a partner in a car. And in this case, it was Kato, and he made Robin look like a child, you know? Bruce Lee did, right? Anyway, my point is that, like, you know, as a regular viewer of movies, even sci-fi movies myself, since I don't follow anime or comic books or graphic novels, you know, I don't know who all these people are. So it's a good question. Like, would I even consider looking, would I watch Prophet or would I wait till it came on Netflix and depending on the trailer, I might watch it. You know, if I hadn't heard about it from you right now, it would have never been on my radar, right?
But then we talked about that in a previous episode. There is starting to become just this brand loyalty too, where, you know, I think I could convince you to see anything that Marvel puts out because Marvel is now a brand that you recognize produces quality entertainment.
Exactly.
Right. Yep. So it almost flips that way. And that's where I think about things like Prophet. How do you break through that cacophony where, you know, there's this sort of, you know, the Titanic versus a tugboat. How do you rise above? How do you break through when you're going up against this monolithic thing?
So it's funny, though, like that you bring up Marvel, too, because, I mean, you're right. Now they're the Levi's of movies, but I mean, the thing is that you guys know what Levi's are, right? But the thing
maker
is
of the Canadian tuxedo, of course.
Yeah, no, that yeah, that, I thought that was Wrangler actually, but or Lee. But like as a kid, I mean, I had, you know, you remember I told you the story. I had these gray figures that I got from, and you know, you and I are both kicking ourselves because we don't have them anymore. But I had Thor, I had Spider-Man, I had Iron Man and Hulk, right? Mm-hmm. And there was five of them. There's one more. I can't remember who it was. But I was never a fan of Iron Man. I never really got Iron Man. I never understood Iron Man. You know, yeah, he's a metal suit guy. Woohoo. Mm-hmm. I never really got it as a kid, right? And then so when the Iron Man movie came out, I was like, oh, Iron Man. Okay, whatever. And, you know, I like Robert Downey Jr., obviously, right? And Pepper Potts, obviously. But it just, to me, I would not have, if you hadn't said, hey, let's go see this movie, I probably wouldn't have just chosen to go see Iron Man. I mean, I know that's a shocker, but, you know, and I think by the time Spider-Man movies came out, I was probably a little tired of Spider-Man too. Like, cause I had, you know, grew up with the cartoon on Channel 9 and all that kind of stuff. So to me, Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man were probably the three main characters on my radar as growing up, mm-hmm. even as a young adult. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's surprising that it's surprising that Iron Man, you know, kind of carried or started that whole Feige, you know, Marvel-verse, right? Marvel Universe, right?
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I wouldn't go out of my way to watch Iron Man 2 or Iron Man 3, you know, like just, you know, like, well, if I wouldn't stop to watch those. I might watch the Captain America stuff because that was always interesting. I had no, oh, that was the other character that was in that set that I had as a kid was Captain America. I mean, I had no idea who he was until the movies came out. I mean, I knew the character, but I'd never read a book or seen him on TV or in a cartoon or whatever. Like, to me, Saturday morning cartoons was my reference for that kind of stuff growing up.
Right? So I'm really curious to continue this over to Jaime because I want to know just generationally where, like, if those are the ones that resonated for you, the sort of Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, those are the ones that jump out for you. Jaime, who was it for your generation that were the characters that were just like right there?
Yeah, I think the recognition definitely would have been there for the Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. The other ones like Green Lantern and Flash and Aquaman are probably not going to be front and center for mainstream folks my age and not, you know, comic book fans, because that's a little different. I do think that you end up with probably more like the X-Men and the Wolverines being, that was like really definitely, like Wolverine was on every dang X team of some sort.
Right? Oh, yeah.
It's like, wait, he's on the West Coast team and the regular East Coast team. How's that possible? Is he like racking up those frequent flyer miles? What's going on, right? They put him in everything. They teamed him up with everybody. And so I think that grittier era, I mean, you've got, you know, like the Venom. I think Venom took his sort of anti-hero sort of approach around that time. You had mm-hmm. Ghost Rider, a lot of...
The Punisher.
Punisher. Yeah, yeah. Who was not like a new character, but he got a grittier sort of approach.
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s, he really just got, he was in the same thing as Wolverine. Every book, every crossover had three monthly titles, was just as big as any other character in comics at that point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned X-Men too, because that's another group of people that I would only have known through the movie. Well, my first exposure to them was on Sega, right? When you were playing the games, right?
Yeah.
You know, I had no idea who Wolverine was. It's a yellow guy and jumping around, and Storm was, you know, she used to fly in lightning bolt people, and that was my reference to those people, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, then when the movies came out, I just kind of went along and you know, watched them, and thank God Patrick Stewart was there to carry the movie, right? and I shouldn't say that, and as well as
Hugh Jackman, Halle Berry, and
the Canadian girl, what's her name?
Oh, Anna Paquin.
Yeah. She carried that one too. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I mean, and they were, again, they were good, well-produced movies, right? So mm-hmm. did they come out before Iron Man?
Yes. They were sort of the first foray into higher quality comic book adapted filmmaking. There were certainly movies before them. Some were better than others. Blade really was the sort of best of the bunch.
Right, right. Yeah. But Blade was an odd one too.
It was, and it was a bit obscure, and I think that's why it worked and resonated. But X-Men was the first one, and again, they didn't really fully embrace, you know, they were much more sort of streamlined, less garish costumes. But that was really the first time where people were like, okay, this could work. And it helped pave that path towards the Marvel Cinematic Universe we know now. Without that, right. It doesn't exist. It doesn't have the traction.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. All right. Well, the next story is from me, and it's about a couple of Canadian filmmakers, and I put them them on here because, you know, first of all, they're Canadian and we should celebrate our Canadian people, but because they're the people who put together the Paw Patrol movie. Come on.
Woo!
Yes, tongue firmly planted in cheek. This is the story for Jaime. Interesting, though, I learned a few things about Paw Patrol that I didn't know. Was that Ian Armitage, how do you say his name? Ian, the kid who plays young Sheldon,
okay,
is the voice of the main pup, and he's not. Yeah, and in the trailer, you know, he says, "You're a dog." He says, "No, I'm not a dog. I'm a pup, a puppy." Right. So, of course, Jaime probably knew that already, but
it looks like Ian Armitage.
Yes. Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, Barlin and Brunker are the two Canadian gentlemen who are talking about. You know, they've, you know, made such classics as The Nut Job 2, Son of Bigfoot, Arctic Dogs, Monster Zone. I mean, come on, you know. But surprisingly, Barlin was actually, I didn't know this at the time, but Barlin was also a writer for George Strummel Love List Tonight. So Bob Barlin and Carl Brunker, Toronto natives, who were the geniuses behind the Paw Patrol franchise, verse. Paw Patrol verse? Paw verse? Anyway.
Yeah, the key takeaway line when I looked at, because they're talking about how they didn't want to just do like a big episode for Paw Patrol, is they said, we wanted to focus on a character's main story and go on an emotional journey with him, which I think is exactly what I described as like, oh, that's a surprising through line story and some actual character growth.
Wow. Yeah. This story was originally written by the Star, but there's a reason why I didn't quote the Star here. They've something about like they I don't know, they had some sort of pun that the Canadian that I've got the link here from didn't bring over, which is kind of funny, which is how I spotted it in the first place. But you know, we put it up there for Jaime's sake anyway. Alrighty, well kids, we're at that part of the show where we start talking about Star Trek Lower Decks, season 2, episode number 9. It was spelled in Klingon, I believe, on the title screen today, so I'm going to go with Wedge Juj, as it was spelt out on IMDb. So, and again, we're just going to do sort of a loose recap this time again, or just hit the high points. But so we start off in the Cerritos, where they're about to go on a long trip. They're going to be traveling for quite a while at warp speed, so the captain decides to let the crew have some R&R, and so the Lower Decks crew are, you know, hanging out in the cafeteria as they do, having their breakfast, discussing, you know, their bridge buddies that they're going to be hanging out with. So, you know, everybody's got, like, Mariner has to go hang out with the captain, which is, wow, what a drag.
Well, it's her mom, you know.
Yeah, her mom. Tendi has to hang out with Dr. Tana, who's her bridge buddy, and of course Rutherford is going to hang out with Shax, which is going to be lots of fun, right? Of course, you know, Baby Bear and Shax hanging out, and there's going to be nobody for Boimler to hang out with, so he's a little put out with that. And so he says something, which is a really interesting line. He says, you know, I wish we had social structures like, you know, like the Borg or the Vulcans or the Klingons. And at which point, you know, Mariner says, or Becky says, you know, you have no idea what it's like to be on a Klingon ship. You didn't know what you would even survive a minute. So we smash cut over to another version. So the titles come up again, and it's this time it's in Klingon, and it's the Klingon Lower Decks. And of course, you know, we head down into the Lower Decks of a Vulcan cruiser, and we meet four Lower Decks folks. You know, there's parallel characters in those ones, and the Boimler one is talking about how it would be a great honor to go and serve with the captain and maybe get in a skirmish and, you know, help back the captain up as he takes a challenge from somebody else and that kind of stuff. And, you know, the logical thing to do would be to you know, put yourself in this position. And one of them screams out, you know, logic, what are you, a Vulcan? At which point we smash cut over to a Vulcan ship. Oh, they're joking about Vulcans, and the one line they say, you know, avoid death and cower is the Vulcan, way. But so they smash cut over to the Vulcan Lower Decks, and so we're on a ship now, and this time, and they're all dealing with you know, their sort of thing. And one of them says, you know, would you be available for chess? And the other one says, no, I have to do, you know, this and that and whatever. And one just sort of says, I'm available for chess. And very very stern, you know, emotionless Vulcan dialogue going on there, which is great. So we come back to, so they're talking about it, and this, and the one Vulcan is, she looks a lot like Beckett, or sorry, Mariner. She's saying she has this, you know, she's been doing the extra scanning and, you know, going deep range and out of her assigned, you know, duties, and because she feels that it would be the right thing to do. And they're like, feel, whoa, you're totally out of control, but yeah, in a very deadpan Vulcan way, right? And then we go back over to the Vulcan ship, and of course there's a skirmish on the bridge as one of the lieutenants takes on the captain to try and win, you know, the captain's seat. And I thought it was interesting that as the captain, you know, pushes the blade into all the Vulcan's chest, that you get that sort of, I thought, purple blood, because you remember in Undiscovered Country they had, mm-hmm, the purple blobs of Klingon blood flung around. Mm-hmm. So because they don't have red blood, they have, but they described it as purple or pinkish red blood in at one point in this thing.
Yeah, it looks like Pepto-Bismol almost.
Yeah. Yeah, so we come back to the Cerritos, and Boimes has decided he needs to go and snag a bridge buddy. So he goes up to, I've forgotten his name now,
Kayshon,
and starts talking Temerian to him. And of course, they have a really interesting, you know, funny dialogue, gobbledygook conversation, at which point, you know, Boimler says something to Kayshon and insults him. And you know, Kayshon gets up, I've been working on my weight, and I don't know why you would say that, and runs away, right? So that's not working out for him. Anyway, so, you know, then he goes and checks in on Shanks and Rutherford. And of course, they're working, they're spinning their clay on the, I forgot to mention they're going to work on pottery, but so they're working on the clay, and, you know, Shanks is talking about how you put your rage into the clay and force it into, you know, into being and that kind of stuff. And I forget what Boimler says to him, but he gets quite upset with Boimler.
Well, he basically insults his weight accidentally by using the wrong Temerian phrase, right?
Oh, no, he talks about Bajor. He says, is this what you like to do?
Sorry,
back on Bajor?
Yeah.
And of course, Bajor is like, because apparently, he's part of the underground.
Yeah,
part of the resistance. And so, of course, you know, he's very upset to have Bajor referenced. And Rutherford, you know, stands between him and Boimler and says, put your rage into the clay. And so that calms him down. So put it in the clay.
We go back over to, because he's Baby Bear, right?
That's right. He says Papa Bear. Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
And we go back to the Vulcan ship, and of course now the character whose name is Talin, is now in trouble with and she's been sent up to see the commander of the Vulcan ship, and of course voiced by Thomas Lennon. I don't know if you know that character, that guy. He's been in a few sitcoms and stuff like that. Very distinct voice.
Yep.
Anyway, he's the Vulcan commander, and he's talking to Talin about, you know, how she needs to work on her self-control. She's like, you know, she's, you know, feelings and impulses and these kind of things are unbecoming of a Vulcan person. And he's like, you know, you should go to your room and do some self-meditation for a while and, you know, get centered again. And she's like, no way, I've got too much work to do. And he's like, I order this, and you will go and meditate. Anyway, so we come over back to the Cerritos, and this time Tendi and Dr.
Ta'ana
is they're doing the climb up the rock face, like I forget which was it number five.
Yes, sadly. Mm-hmm,
yes, your favorite movie, Star Trek V. And of course, you know, Boimler shows up with Spock's Hubbard boots, right? And let's say another throwback to that one. And of course, you know, he loses control over it and starts falling, and Tendi's like, yeah, the safety protocols are on. And Ta'ana says, I don't know, what do I care? And of course, you know, so we see Boimler sit landing in a tree. Yeah, so then we and of course he's like, he's given up on trying to find a bridge buddy. He's kind of lost, and he runs into the elevator or the turbolift, and he runs into Commander Ransom and two other one's clearly an alien, the blue aliens that breathe the special oxygen, and talking about how, you know, they're talking about how they're going to do a Hawaii sort of thing, a luau, and Boimler's like, oh yeah, Hawaii, like with the sand and the shirts and stuff. And they're like, oh, are you from Hawaii too? And he goes, yeah, I'm from Hawaii. So of course, you know, he gets caught in this lie, and of course all three of them are saying they're from Hawaii, including the blue dude who's like breathing the special oxygen. And he says, well, come and join us and hang out. We'll do some Hawaiian stuff together. And away they go, right? We see, there's a scene there where he also goes to visit Mariner and her mother, who are, you know, are fighting off simulations with their phasers and yelling at each other about, you know, how people are acting and what have you. And at the end of it, you know, Mariner comes out and says, this is the longest warp of my life, you know. So the back on the Klingon ship, the captain reveals his. Well, I think by this time that the young Klingon has won honor. I think he defeats one of the people and gets chosen to be the chosen one. He's went and got the blood wine. And he's walked the Vulcan pet. I forgot the name of it.
The Klingon Targ.
Yeah. He walks the commander's Targ and you know, wins honor. So the captain reveals that the Empire is going to use the pack lads. They're going to give them enough weapons, and I don't know any. I've never heard of any situation where a large power would give another smaller power weapons and cause them to go start a war somewhere.
Well, to point out though, it was not the Empire. It's this guy, right? It's this ship
guy.
Commander.
Yeah. Well, he said we can claim for the region for our Empire, but he's been feeding supplying the pack lads with weapons, so they will attack the Federation, right? Mm. Anyway, and of course the packlet guy goes, yeah, we really liked the bomb you sent us, but, you know, it stopped working after we used it. And the guy, it's like a bomb. It only works once, you know, kind of thing. Anyway, back on Cerritos, you know, they run into trouble as they start getting attacked by the packlets, and everybody's concerned. And Boimler's concerned because he's like, I don't want to die in a Hawaiian shirt. And they all look at him like, what? What, man? And it turns out that he sits down and admits that he's not really from Hawaii. He's actually from I forget where he said now, Modesto, California. So the blue alien dude says, yeah, well, I'm not really from Hawaii either. I just said that to get along with you guys. And then the other lady says, I'm not from there either. I said that as well. And then Ransom also admits that he's not from Hawaii. He mentioned it when he was a young cadet, and he had to carry on the fiction for his whole career. And he's actually, I'm actually from the moon. And, you know, the young lady says, I'm also from the moon. And turns out that the blue dude is also from the moon of his system, and so they're like, they're all, hey, we're all moon buddies. And then, you know, Boimler, who of course feels now left out again, says, well, Modesto's kind of like a moon, and
it's the moon of San Francisco.
Yeah, they're like, no, it's not, you know. Anyway, but anyway, they forgive him, and he still gets to be pals with them. And so the funny part is of course, you know, we have to sort of, in theme of this show, of seeing how all the lower decks work across the various different societies or races or species, whatever. We have to sort of see the pack led lower decks, and they're just sitting there going, I'm hungry too. Yeah, they're not really doing anything as their ship is in the middle of a war. So the young Klingon, ends up killing the captain and becomes the captain of the ship, surprisingly. So he decides he's against the whole setting up the packlets kind of deal, and refuses not to do it, and stabs his knife into the deck, which point the captain attacks him, and he ends up killing the captain with the help of the Targ, because the Targ comes and bites the captain in mid fury, because I guess the Targ likes the young Klingon, and the young Klingon, I can't remember, I don't know if he had a name, but he becomes the captain of the ship, and he decides, well, we'll just, you know, he decides to leave and leave the war and or this little skirmish and what have you, right? I mean, there is a battle that happens between the Packlet and the Klingon ship and the Cerritos, and they're all in this big, you know, Star Trek type war thing. But when the Klingons leave, the Packlets kind of lose it, and Cerritos blasts the Packlet ship. Oh, by the way, I just wanted to point out too that I forgot to mention that when they're working out, like, you know how we have the disco shirts for the disco workout for the Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Freeman is wearing a Ritos shirt.
I was gonna say, when do we order our Ritos shirts?
Exactly. I think that's coming, right? And then, the captains, again, the Vulcan captains, again, talking to T'Lyn about how, you know, she's, we can't have you, you know, like, you know, your style of emotions and feelings and instincts can't, you know, that's not the Vulcan way. And, you know, she's like, okay, I'll pack up my things and go back to Vulcan. He goes, no, I'm going to reassign you to a Starfleet ship because you'll fit right in over there. So it's kind of funny because I kind of envisioned like, okay, so we're going to get like some more characters on the Cerritos, you know, we'll have a Vulcan and we'll have a Klingon and whatever. And the best, I think the best joke is at the end there when, after all said and done, we go and see the Borg Lower Decks, folks as the titles of the show run. And of course the, in the Borg, they're all just, you know, they're all plugged into their sleeping, what do they call those charging stations or whatever? Their key charging stations. And of course they're just standing there being charged, right? Because that's what, you know, you just plug yourself in the computer when you're a Borg, right?
Yeah, the whole concept of a Lower Decks for the Borg was kind of interesting when they went there. And I watched, I was like, maybe they'll do something different. I watched through the credits and I didn't see it. They're just there quietly in their alcove, maybe, with 7 and 9 called it?
Yeah, I don't know. They had a name for it when 7, because 7 had to have one as well. That's where she hibernated, right? Hibernation chamber, maybe? But anyway, that's sort of the what was interesting about this particular episode was how they kind of, they did the perspective of all the very, like, you know, set up by Boimler's statement at the beginning of the show, you know, what's the Lower Deck look like on the Klingon ship and what's the Lower Deck look like on the Vulcan ship and the Paklid ship and of course the Borg ship. So we get this sort of, and it's funny because every time they went to a different alien species, they did the titles in of that particular, you know, said the Vulcan Lower Decks and the Klingon Lower Decks.
We actually did get the Paklid Lower Decks too, right?
Yeah, so I mentioned that. That's about where I'm hungry. I'm hungry too.
I am hungry. You should eat. You are smart.
Yeah.
I love it. The line made me laugh out loud. I am hungry. You should eat. You are smart.
You are smart. Yeah. So, but you know, interesting. Like, you know, like I love that kind of thing where you get the different thing, and it's kind of like a mirror universe episode because we get to see the different perspectives. And in fact, that's the original Lower Decks was the original Lower Decks on the Next Generation was the same sort of deal. Was, you know, what happens to the crew when they're not, you know, if they're off duty, what do they do? And you know, what are the people who clean the toilets do? Right, sort of thing deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah,
this wasn't much crate stacking in this show, though.
No, surprisingly little considering. But then I guess that's the kind of the point, is different crew, different deals. But
right, yeah.
All right, so two questions. One, which crew would you least like to be on, most like to be on?
Well, yeah. I think the Vulcans are probably, or sorry, the Klingons are probably too extreme for me. I don't think I would enjoy being on a Klingon ship. Even like, you know, the episode where Riker goes and serves on one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess the Vulcans is kind of interesting, but yeah, you.
But the passive aggressiveness of the Vulcans, like the line at the end where, you know, she gets reassigned to the Federation ship and she sort of turns, looks over her shoulder and says, "Live long and prosper, sir." May as well have been like, "Live long and go F yourself." Like, it was just, like the most perfect Vulcan, you know, insult within a salute that made me laugh.
Yeah, sorry, Jaime, I cut you off.
No, I was thinking that the Federation ship is probably the easiest to deal with because the Klingon ship would be full of danger as people either intentionally trying to hurt you or just accidentally hurting you in their boisterous celebrations. And then the Vulcan one would be hard to do. I mean, you saw how the running joke was like, you know, you're getting kicked off the ship because of your emotional outbursts, right? Yeah. You're completely calm,
you are
rational.
Out of control. Yeah.
Yeah. Acting like a child. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. From the episode, I also enjoyed the "cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war" phrase. A nice little tip of the hat to
Christopher Plummer line. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My favorite quote from the episode, I wrote this one down because it made me laugh, is from the first scene on the Klingon ship when they're going their separate ways, and the one guy says, "Save me a seat at lunch. Unless I die an honorable death, then someone else can have it."
Right. Right.
Yeah. Also, avoid death and cower was also like, I just love that they're like, you know, the vaguely racist statements going back and
live
forth.
Live long and prosper. Yeah.
Live long and prosper becomes avoid death and cower.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. Again, I think these guys are on a roll. I thought last week's was extremely funny with the holodecks playing on all the Star Trek tropes. This one is a little more accessible just because it's pretty much straight as it is. You do have to know, obviously, a little bit about the different races, but I thought this was super, super funny. I loved Freeman and Mariner playing what seemed to be Federation Clue, where they were like, I think it was the chef in the, you know, hallway with the, you know, sniper rifle that can shoot through walls. And she says, you always think it's the chef. And she says, yeah, because we have replicators. What the heck do we need a chef for? It's always sketchy.
Is that what they're yelling at each other about? I kind of missed that.
That's what they're, so the first scene they're having the sort of the holodeck fight thing. And then she calls her back up to her chambers or her quarters, and they're playing that game when they get the call that they have to go investigate this anomaly. Yeah. I also like that the Packled ship that says red alarm.
Red alarm. Red alarm. Red alarm. Red alarm. Yeah.
And the best one was when they were on the Vulcan ship and they were talking about how, you know, this Vulcan was having emotional outbursts, even though from our perspective, she's not having any of them. And they talk about punitive spiritualism. That is the best thing I've ever heard. That's like the most perfect encapsulation of, like, you know, people who are devoutly religious. Punitive spiritualism.
Yeah,
you have to be punished.
Ten Hail Marys and five Our Fathers. And
I love that phrase. That is so good. That is what I strive to avoid in with every fiber of my lifetime is punitive spiritualism.
Well, and it's like the one woman who says to Lynn says, you know, I had to scan because, you know, I was trying to look into these weird anomalies or what, and the other Vulcan says, by definition, anomalies are weird.
Yes. Yeah.
Strange.
So is Talin coming to the Cerritos?
I don't know. I mean, that's what I was sort of like. She looked very. She's very. She reminds me. She reminded me of Mariner, right?
She's the crap disturber of her team, right?
Yeah.
By our standards, she's, you know, incredibly capable and thoughtful and creative, but they don't value any of that, right?
Yeah, I think the Klingon dude was Boimler, right? Am I right there, or do you think it was Rutherford?
Yeah, I think he was supposed to be sort of the by the books character, like Boimler.
Right. Yeah.
I did
yeah.
like that. Mark Evan Jackson, who is an actor, he was Sean on The Good Place, the big bad villain from Hell and The Good Place, and he was also on Brooklyn Nine-Nine as Kevin for a long time. He did two of the voices on this week's episode too. He was that the sort of sandy-haired Vulcan, and he was also the blue alien whose race I cannot fish out. We'll have to look at next week. There, he did two of the voices, but he has such a distinctive voice. I immediately like grabbed hold of it. I was like, I love Mark Evan Jackson. He's so good.
Mm. Yeah, it was really. I enjoyed this episode. I'm sorry that I had to take notes because I would like just sit back and watch it. It would have been fun.
Oh, this one will be worth. I mean, so much of this season will be worth a rewatch. You know, I've rewatched a couple of them a few times. Sometimes Xavier and I can't line our schedules up, so we watch them, and I'll just sit and rewatch them with him when he watches it, just because they're really clicking. This has been a great season.
Yeah, we watched it together today because he's here today, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, so I guess we should talk about What If next, right?
Yes, what if the Watcher broke his oath and Jonathan got what he wanted again,
and the oath is not to interfere.
Yes. So just the 30-second recap coming off last week's episode, where we have this sort of ultra-aware Ultron who is, you know, inside the Vision's body and is empowered by the Infinity Stones and has now basically become this, you know, sort of semi-omnipotent creature who can see through the multiverses. The Watcher decides to sort of go through and do a greatest hits from this season of What If and cherry pick all these characters from the different episodes to create the Guardians of the Multiverse. So he gets Star-Lord T'Challa, he gets Captain Carter, he gets Frat Boy Thor, he gets, who am I missing?
Zoe Saldana character.
Oh, that's right. Gamora. He gets Gamora last year.
And he doesn't choose Tony Stark.
Right. And basically brings them together so that they can... Oh, an evil Doctor Strange or this Doctor Strange Supreme.
He started the whole thing with him last week, right?
Yeah. And so the whole episode basically builds around how do they stop this semi-omnipotent creature? How do they do this? And they concoct a couple of different strategies to try and, you know, take away the stones and depower him and do things differently. And it's sort of a nice sort of culmination of the season, and also brings back some of these sort of fan favorites. We even get a nice moment where we get the Marvel Zombies coming into play in mass quantities at one point, including the zombified Scarlet Witch.
Right. Yeah.
So, I thought it was an interesting episode, an interesting way to wrap up the season. What were your takeaways, guys?
Well, it was interesting. I like the twist where, you know, their plot is to get some of the stones or all of the stones and destroy them, mm-hmm. and they figure that's going to be the key to their survival. But spoilers for people who haven't seen it yet? But the twist is that when they destroy the stones, they only end up destroying the stones in Gamora's universe.
Yeah, that doesn't work for them. Yeah.
So, it doesn't work in all the places, right? So, and there's a lot of battling back and forth, and Doctor Strange plays a huge role in terms of casting protection spells on them, right? So that's sort of a nice sort of bit of armor for them to have, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then of course Black Widow shows up, and it's the dialogue between Captain Carter and Black Widow is that, you know, she convinces her to join them because she's the only survivor on her particular world, Black Widow, and she convinces her that, you know, they're actually friends in their own universe, in the other universes, right? So they join forces, and she plays a key role in the defeating of first Ultron, and then second who takes over.
Oh yes, Killmonger. That was the other character. Was the Killmonger that ends up sort of duplicitously becoming Black Panther and taking over Wakanda. That was the other character for the team.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that was my subtitle to this one. But what if Killmonger was still an ass?
Yeah,
they really, it's funny, like they really have done that character pretty consistently dirty. Like I really thought at some point there would be a redemption arc, but even when they brought him on board, I was like, oh, that's gonna end badly.
Yeah, and I thought it was kind of interesting that you end up with the misguided Doctor Strange playing like penance, right? Mm-hmm. By always having to watch the I forget the Hydra Nazi doctor's name, and
Arnim Zola.
Yes, thank you. And Killmonger battling it out infinitely in that little pocket universe. That's like a pocket inside a pocket, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that's kind of a neat, nifty one.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had Strange with the Time Stone, so he was able to fight Ultron at some equivalent level when Ultron was trying to use the Time Stone to he's like slowing down time and then taking the stones in that part of the scene.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny though, because all things being equal, I felt like Thanos was a much better master of the stones. Like, you know, the way that he used those stones in those Avengers movies where he, you know, he changed reality and he did things and sort of never fell prey to what other people expected from him. I feel like maybe it was because of the type of character that Ultron is, but he wasn't as creative in his use of the stones. Obviously, it just suits the story needs, but he wasn't really, I think, using them to the potential that Thanos kind of found.
Yeah, I think maybe there's some difference in how the characters approach things, given that in this timeline that we were watching, you had Ultron just immediately decide to bisect Thanos, right? Before Thanos could even think about what to do. So that sort of machine efficiency was there, but maybe lacking the creativity of a living being and what you would do with infinite power.
Yeah. What did you guys make of the stinger, the last little bit within the credits where we see, spoilers, Captain Carter discovers that Steve / the Iron, what do they call it?
It's like Smasher?
Hydra Smasher. Yeah, that the Hydra Smasher armor has survived into, you know, the 2000s like she has, and that Steve is theoretically inside. Is that just supposed to be the happy ending, or is that to be continued?
Mm. feels like to be continued. Like other people, yes, because they did us a little dirty on this one, and this is why. Just for anybody who's watching this on streaming, just, you know, fast forward until you stop seeing stuff. This is the only time this season that was actually worthwhile, I think.
Yep.
Where it's after they do the credits, where they have like the backgrounds of the different episodes art, they actually did have the little stinger with Captain Carter and getting that info. And I'm not the only one in the internet to think this. It did feel like the Winter Soldier for her.
It did. Yeah.
Felt like that was what they were setting up.
Yeah. And we do know we're getting a season two. I wonder if we're going to see more of the same characters or if we're going to continue to explore new worlds and where we'll go from there. But yeah, I guess now that we sort of reached the end of the road for season one, do you guys have any overall impressions? Do you feel like it was, you know, time well spent? Do you think, you know, does it rank well with other Marvel experiences for you?
Yeah, I think it was a good show. I come back to in one side of me is glad that they kind of brought all these sort of weird stories together because it kind of brings some cohesiveness to it. But I also still like the anthology style of storytelling where you don't have to have them connected, right? You know.
Yeah, I mean, each of those episodes up until a point kind of overlapped and worked well together. I feel like it really was only in the last few where things started to sort of tie together. I don't know if it works better as a full anthology, and I do wonder if we will see any spillover, if we'll see any of these characters within the cinematic MCU, if we'll see a Captain Carter, if we'll see any of those characters spin out, or if this is just sort of its own contained thing.
Hard to say. All right, should we move on to our watch lists?
Hell yeah.
Sure.
Hell yeah. All right, Jaime, you're up first. What Picard thing do you have first this week?
Mine actually was, you know, based on the episode of Lower Decks. This is actually quite timely. So this is a comic. It's SheldonComics.com. Despite the name, it does not have anything to do with the Big Bang Theory character. This is a different web comic. But the basic premise is, you know, why do Star Trek ships always meet nose to nose as if it was, you know, like sailing ships on the ocean, you know, in 3D space? They should be oriented in all sorts of weird ways, but they don't do that, right? And the cool battle that we saw in today's episode definitely had them all on more or less the same plane, same orientation. And this comic is not going to play well in audio medium. Go check out the show notes for those of you transporting at home. It shows you why, you know, for the art side of these episodes, they don't do it that way, because even if it was more realistic, like, it would look dumb. It would look weird and odd to your eye that these different shifts are just like, what, that one's crooked. Why are they lining up like that?
That's exactly what I thought when you asked the question. Why would they? All right, cool.
I've got the Lego Star Wars Terrifying Tales, which is now up on Disney Plus. I watched this today. It was entertaining. They treat it very similarly to what we saw from the Lego Star Wars holiday special we saw last wintertime, wherein it's sort of a little anthology built around a sort of overarching plot. We see little vignettes set in different time periods. So we see the sort of Rey Finn era. We see the Luke Skywalker era. And then we see a little bit of the prequel era. And it's typical Lego Star Wars fare. It's funny. It's got some sort of goofy moments. Obviously, it's probably better aimed at a younger audience. But there was definitely enough there for me to enjoy and laugh and some of the tropes. And you know, it is the closest thing we have to a Lower Decks kind of thing for Star Wars, where we have something just on the sort of lighter side, you know, taking the guff out of Star Wars universe. So, yeah, it's definitely worth a watch. It's, you know, it's 45 minutes. It's an enjoyable 45 minutes and probably worth a watch.
And it's based around the whole Halloween theme?
Yeah, each one of them is sort of a sort of a spooky tale set within that, instead of doing the story of the monkey's paw, they do the story of the Wookiee's paw. You know, they sort of go these different sort of directions, and they're telling all these stories inside of Darth Vader's abandoned old castle. Hill, and it's sort of the haunted house kind of theme to it. Again, always very sort of kid friendly. It never goes very far. There is sort of a zombie motif at one point with sort of the Night of the Living Dead, but it's the battle droids and, you know, Roger. There's some funny stuff in there that, you know, again, it sort of picks up off of you know, taking some fun and taking some of the fun stuff out of the Star Wars universe. It's like I say, it's definitely worth it.
All right. Well, I've got a couple of things here. No Time to Die opens tomorrow as we record. Actually, it opens today. I think there were some showings today, surprisingly. And I looked at the sort of seating plans for the IMAX in particular. It looks like they're selling seats in pairs and then a space between them. So they must have some sort of algorithm that shows you the available seats based on the number. Because I noticed that one person had bought three seats together, and they must have some algorithm to do that. But of course, you know, I think, you know, the first day you're going to see this thing, it's going to be packed, or it's going to fill up quick. Some showings had sold out already, but yeah, it'd be interesting to see that. I want to see that one on the IMAX, but maybe we'll wait till midweek when the furor dies down. Did we went the second week, right, John? We didn't go the first week to Shang-Chi?
Oh, well past that. I think we actually saw it 4 weeks out.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the tricky part is if we want to see any of these movies that are coming out in October on IMAX, there'll be a faster rotation just because there's more volume of movies coming out. So we'll have to sort of see what makes sense if we feel comfortable, obviously, going to different types of shows. Because the Bond movie's out now, but then, you know, Dune is dropping soon and then Eternals is dropping soon. So we're going to see a lot more turnover in those theaters than there was before.
Yeah, so I had Dune down here too, because the final trailer, they call it the final trailer. I don't know why they call it final trailer, but the final trailer for Dune dropped today, I think.
Is that different from the one we saw at the theater last week?
I don't know. I haven't watched it yet, but I just saw it. I just noticed today it said final trailer, but like as if
the one we saw in the theater was one I'd never seen before. It was definitely more plot focused.
Yeah, this could be the one. But anyway, the that's coming. When's that coming into theater? Do you know?
Dune.
I know it was at the film festival, but. Yeah,
Dune is HBO Max on the 22nd, so I think it's opening the same day on theaters.
Really?
Yep, you're absolutely right.
I got an email
are you
about
sit
that.
Really close to the TV when you watch that one, Jaime?
I mean, that's how you can get a pro tip, life pro tip. This is how you get a bigger TV experience, is by just sitting closer to it.
Yeah. Or hold the iPad closer to your face. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just take your iPhone and put it on like as if it was VR goggles, and you have a massive like 80-inch TV equivalent.
Well, can't you watch movies on those PlayStation thingies?
Oh, the VR goggles? Yeah, no, you can.
Yeah.
You can.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that would be my ideal viewing experience, but yeah, you can.
Well, you know, you get the surround sound and all that, right? So
sure.
It's all exciting. Just, you know, have somebody like blow popcorn past your nose as you're watching it, you know?
Yeah,
give you a big gulp to drink.
It'll be hard to replicate that experience that we had last week of an IMAX theater to ourselves. That seems like a once in a lifetime kind of deal.
Yeah, we didn't have a 10-second rewind, though. That's the only problem.
That's true. It would have been nice if we did. That would have the only thing that would have made it perfect is if we could pause just so we can make wise-assed comments while we watch.
Yeah, exactly. Or I could go back and watch the parts I slept through.
That would also be good, yeah.
Yeah.
The good news is it's coming to Disney Plus in November, so you'll be able to catch up.
Yeah, I noticed that Free Guy is already on the Disney, right?
Mm-hmm.
All righty. Okay, well, I guess, is Black Widow free and clear now, or
yeah,
is it
just
still...
this week it's now free for anybody who has Disney Plus.
Hasn't seen it? Right. Well, we recommend you watch Black Widow and Free Guy.
Mm-hmm.
When you get around to it, you watch Shang-Chi, but yeah, your mileage may vary. So I guess that's it for another week. So until next time, Jonathan, how do we find you?
You can always get me on Instagram and Twitter as @JPKNews.
All righty, Jaime. Why would we want to get in touch with you, Jaime? Yeah, why would we want to get in? Jaime, what the hell, right? So Jaime, how would we get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter as @DevOfTheHair.
All right. My name is Timitra, TimMitra. Oh, one more thing before we go. There is one more thing. This is a couple of days past the anniversary of Steve Jobs passing 10 years ago.
Mm.
And I'm part of a group called James Dempsey and the Breakpoints. I call myself a conditional breakpoint because that's a coding joke. But so we put together a song called One More Thing. James Dempsey wrote it, and he asked a bunch of us to provide background vocals and guitars, and you know, one of the guys even played a didgeridoo. So there's violins and strings and electric guitars and stuff like that, and we're all singing this song called One More Thing, which is a tribute to Steve Jobs, and the lyrics are all things that Steve Jobs would have said during his keynotes. So give it a listen, enjoy, and all that kind of stuff, and until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future. Not a lot of links for us, I guess.
Yeah, right? We didn't have a ton of news this week. I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually had a really super busy week at work this week, and yeah. I sat down to look at it today. I was like, oh, there's only a couple things in there. Maybe I'll have a look around, and I really only found a couple more things
that were worth talking about. It's those slouchers you do the show with, you know? Yeah.
Well, it's funny, because it goes in cycles. Like, last week, we seemed like we had a ton of news. The week before that was a little slow, so it seems like it's coming in waves, but...
Yeah, yeah, we'll
tomorrow,
see.
We're getting the trailer for Lost in Space Season 3 is supposed to drop on Netflix, and I imagine they'll announce the drop date, so stay tuned for that. Hmm.
All right.
I saw the official Netflix Lost in Space feed posted that today saying, check out tomorrow, trailer coming. I'm looking forward to that one. I actually, I'm glad you turned me on to that one. That was a really enjoyable first couple seasons.
Oh, you like that one? Yeah.
I do. I like the cast. I like the pacing that, you know, that they've put in there. I think it'll be interesting to see if they can stick the landing on it, because I've enjoyed the first two.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Dr. Smith character is always a piece of work in that story. So we'll see, have to see where that goes.
Yeah.
And yeah. They really screwed the pooch on the Lost in Space movie.
They did. Yeah. Yeah. But even the mom and dad, like, they were kind of, in the original series, were kind of dull as dishwater. But the characters, you know, again, Molly Parker, I mean, they've actually made them pretty compelling. And then the relationship between the siblings and the robot. And, yeah, I think they've done a really
funny,
good job.
It's funny you mention that about the original TV series, right? June Lockhart was a huge Western and movie star. And guy, what's his name? I've forgotten his name now. The guy who played the father was actually Zorro. Like, you know, he was quite well known, you know, as an actor. And they were a bit put out when Dr. Smith and Bill Mumy and the robot kind of became the they were sort of the C-3PO and R2-D2 sort of that show. They kind of became the star. Even the, you know, Angela Cartwright and the woman who played Judy and the boyfriend, the co-pilot dude. I mean, they all kind of took a back seat to these three, Dr. Smith, Bill Mumy, or Will Robinson and the robot, right? Mm-hmm, so kind of funny the way that worked out. Yeah. Anywho, because they had more bigger roles, you know, in the early on in the show, but
yeah,
you know, but when you're like 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, you know, it passes as science fiction. It doesn't really hold up when you look at it.
No, I wouldn't say that series necessarily holds up terribly well.
No, it was like, and you can remember too, it was up against Star Trek, right? So it was like it didn't hold a candle at all, right? So anywho, all right.
It's getting colder here.
Yeah. It's actually still kind of strangely warm here. Yeah.
Let's see.
Hey, like, yeah, normally it would be like, you know, it would be getting down in weather. The leaves would be turning color. Thanksgiving is, well, I don't know about you, Jaime, but it's our Thanksgiving this weekend.
And Moose Day.
Moose Day, yeah. So apparently on Moose Day, by Moose Day, the leaves have all changed color and, you know, pretty cold and rainy and whatever. But it's been like summertime weather here. Like, I mean, not typical summertime weather, but like 20 degrees, which is, you know, unheard of.
Yeah, I'm looking at the current weather. It claims it is 64 Fahrenheit, which is 17, almost 18 in Toronto. And right now it is 54 here, which is around 12 Celsius for...
Yeah.
Cold. Yeah, and you're considerably later in the night than we are. So it's kind of interesting that you're staying that warm.
We get a warm, a warming front coming off our Lake Ontario that tends to generally keep the Toronto area warmer.
Plus, we're further south. We'll talk about that on the show.
Yeah. It also, it's funny because you see the forecast and Buffalo is getting hammered and they're just on the other side of the lake from us. But yeah, it's because of the warming effect of the lake that we don't get quite as pounded as they do.
They're hammered with what?
Snow, cold weather, really bad conditions.
Oh, I thought you meant it's snowing today. I'm like, what?
No. Typically in the wintertime, though, they get like way, way, way worse treatment than we do, because by the time those storm fronts go over the lake, it warms and it rises the air and it's not nearly as bad. We don't get it as bad as Buffalo does.
Well, and before global warming, we would have had snow by now for sure.
Usually end of October was sort of when we would sort of see flurries or a little bit. Now, usually it's not till mid-November.
Yeah. I mean, I used to always say that November 14th was when it would start snowing, because when I lived in Owen Sound, there was a guy who used to paint November 14th on the front of his plow, or he would paint something every year, and I just remember seeing November 14th.
I remember going into a Halloween party when I was in college in Belleville, which is about maybe 120 miles from here, Jaime. And I remember going into the party and it was clear and coming out at like, you know, 12 o'clock and it was white, like as far as the eye could see. We were like, it was fall when we went in. The clock struck November 1st and it was like there was snow.
Yeah. I mean, Carol's birthday is the 4th of November. By that time, like, it's the worst weather ever. Like, you know, rainy, miserable, you know, sweaters and all that kind of stuff, right?
So yeah, I'll see you and raise you January the 11th.
Well, you know.
By then, we're in the depths of it.
You could have hung on and been born, like, you know, in March, you know.
Yeah, I was already, like a little bit late, so I don't think my mom would have appreciated that very much.
No?
Probably not, considering I came out at, like, damn near 10 pounds, too.
I was going to say, like, you could have come out at, like, 11 or 12 pounds.
I could have come out like luggage at that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mark's not here. No, it is Mark. Let me in, man.
It's because they say we're going to devolve into Cheech and Chong.
Cheech and Chong. Yeah. Are you familiar with the Cheech and the Chong, Jaime?
I am. And I've seen the, you know, the originals that are, you know, uncut and everything, instead of being the, you know, for TV on Comedy Central. And they change a lot of the drug stuff in particular.
Oh, do they really? Wow.
Yeah. Like, oh my gosh, I can't remember which one. I'm gonna pretend it's Up in Smoke. But when Cheech's cousin or something, like, totally just loses his mind for no reason, if you've only seen the Comedy Central broadcast stuff. But it's like, well, actually, he got like the space coke, and he's completely, you know, high off his rocker. But you miss that because you don't see him going into it. So you're like, why does he look so weird and angry and just flies off into space?
Right.
And that's why, kids, we don't mess with classics.
That's true. Well, you know, it's exactly. But they started out as like, they used to do records. I guess they were stand-up comedians first, right? Like, because they didn't do movies until, like, they had a whole series of, like, probably, like, got to be 5 or 6 records, albums, where they had done before they did the movie, you know, sort of thing, right? That's where this is the classic, you know, Dave's Not Here, Man. That comes from that, from the record days. I guess they must have done, like, live shows, eh, John? Back in those days?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole series of comedians like that. Like, I'm trying to think. The one guy became a director. He worked with a lady. They were
oh,
hilarious.
It was, yeah, I know who you mean. It's,
that guy with the girl.
That guy on that show with that thing. Yeah. Yes, I know exactly who you mean. Elaine May and...
Yeah. Was it Elaine May? No.
No, was it Elaine May? No, yeah, Elaine May and Mike Nichols.
Mike Nichols, yeah. Oh, was it Elaine May? Really?
Yeah. Mm. Oh, I can't believe I pulled that out of my depths of my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did a bunch of comedy albums, and then he went on to be like a very famous director.
Yeah. And then, but they also did TV shows too, right? They were TV writers as well. And then there was Bob Newhart. Well, he was hilarious on his own.
Yep.
He did the one-sided phone calls.
Yeah.
What else is going on? Any baseball to talk about? No? No baseball?
Baseball. Well, Jaime and I both had our hearts broken on Sunday. So
that baseball season's over?
Well, it is from my perspective. I mean, there's really, I was hoping either the Blue Jays would get in. If they couldn't get in, I was hoping that the Mariners would get in just so that there would be something different to root for in there. Now it's just a bunch of teams I couldn't give much of a crap about. And and the Yankees were knocked out and the Cardinals were knocked out, two teams I despise. So not much more I could wish for other than, you know, I guess, I don't know. I actually did watch the Dodgers Cardinals game last night because I despise the Cardinals, being a Reds fan for a long time as well as a Blue Jays fan. So wanted them to lose and they lost in spectacular fashion on a walk-off home run by the Dodgers. So that made me feel really good. And I think, I don't know if I'll keep watching, although the next round, the San Francisco Giants are playing the LA Dodgers, A, for the first time in the playoffs, which is fascinating considering those two are, you know, storied franchises. And also, they were the two best teams in baseball by a distance this year. So that could be a really entertaining series. I might dip into that one. Jaime, are you out now that the Mariners are out? You're just like fully into Seattle Kraken mode?
We still got a few more days. The season for us doesn't kick off. See, I'm even using the wrong terms here. It doesn't start until Tuesday.
Hit the ice, Jaime. Hit the ice.
Drop the puck.
They'll spend their
face
first
off
like five games away to start the season because the Climate Pledge Arena is still getting finished up.
Oh, that name, man. Wow.
So the old Key Arena is Climate Pledge Arena, and they will drop the ice for the home opener against Vancouver.
Yeah.
So they start away at Vegas, and then they'll be at Vancouver.
And that should be, you know,
drop the ice. Where did you get that from?
Well, drop the puck, hit the ice. One of those.
Drop the ice. See, I'm just getting used to it now.
Strap him on.
That Seattle Vancouver thing has potential to be a lot of fun because obviously there's, you know, I wouldn't say maybe you can tell me, Jaime, is there a big rivalry between those cities as is? But it could be a lot of fun because they're so close, right?
Yeah. It's hard to know what will happen because you're growing a fan base here, but there is a natural thing of like, well, Vancouver's right there. There's a lighter rivalry between Seattle and Portland Seattle and Vancouver in soccer in soccer. It's really the Sounders versus the Timbers in Portland, but there is no Portland, correct me if I'm wrong, there is no Portland NHL team. So it seems like a natural thing to create
Portland
a rivalry
has
with
one,
Vancouver.
One major pro. I mean, obviously you can debate that for MLS, but really the Blazers are it, right? And I'm led to understand that there are actually some Blazers fans in Seattle now, which seems sacrilegious, but I guess since there are no Sonics, that's what you got to do, right?
Yeah, no Sonics for, when did they leave? 8?
Way too long. Way too long.
Like 13, going on 14 years and nothing in sight. A lot of energy was spent on like, well, maybe they can build the arena, maybe they can get a team, and then, you know, maybe they'll also get a hockey team, and they actually have a live hockey team starting, and there's no end in sight for the NBA story. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here.
Yeah, I honestly feel like every single day that there's not a team in Seattle is a disgrace for the NBA. I truly do. I think the circumstances under which they got moved to Oklahoma City are reprehensible. And there was such a good fan base. There's such a history of good basketball in Seattle. The fact that there's no team there is genuinely disgraceful.
So here's the thing. I've got a watch list for Jaime, right? You have to watch these movies in the next, you know, little while. The first one is called Slapshot. And that's a must see. That's you'll love that movie even if you don't like hockey. But Slapshot is a great movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. Youngblood is another one.
I was waiting to see if Youngblood came out of you.
Yeah, that's awesome. Youngblood is Rob Lowe as a young Canadian wannabe star.
No, he's American in the movie. He's American. That's the gang.
Goaltender
States.
The goaltender is Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, Keanu Reeves at 18.
Yeah, and I think one of his first movies. Yeah, Patrick Swayze's in that movie, yeah. Then Le Boys might be a stretch for you, but that's an interesting one. And there's another movie, too, that's not on this list, but it's called, it stars Keir DeLay. Let me just look it up here. Actually, when I met him, I talked to him about this movie. He's like, oh my God, nobody's ever brought that movie up. Paperback Cowboy, I think it was called. I saw it once when I was sick. Keir DeLay. Let's have a look at this here. Anyway, there's a Mighty Ducks and The Miracle on Ice, but I wouldn't watch those. They're not going to you're not gonna get much out of them in terms of hockey, but
so the flying like goose or duck wing thing that they do in Mighty Ducks is not
the flying V.
Yeah, that's not legit strategies in the modern NHL.
No,
I think the hockey movie high watermark is Jean-Claude Van Damme's sudden death, where they're in the old igloo at Pittsburgh during the middle of a game, and he's trying to prevent this like terrorist attack. So he's fighting off the bad guys while this NHL playoff game is happening. And at one point, he ends up playing goalie for the Penguins. It is spectacular in its nonsense, but
And this other one is not really, it's a hockey movie. The hockey's in it, but it's kind of interesting. It's called Paperback Hero, and that's the one with Keir Delay. It's a real sort of odd duck of a movie, because and there's some pretty big names in it, surprisingly, but I don't even think Jonathan's even seen that one.
No, I haven't. That one.
Definitely, check those ones out. Slapshot, for sure.
Yeah, Slapshot talks about it. That really speaks to where hockey was, particularly in the American zeitgeist in the 1970s, where everyone just regarded it as just these, Canadian thugs on ice beating the crap out of each
Goon,
other.
Goon, there's a movie called Goon, too. I don't know if you've seen that one. Have you seen that one, John?
Oh, Goon. Yeah, that's, what's his name? Sean, Sean from the...
Spengler, right?
Stifler. Stifler from from the American Pie
American
movies.
Pie, yeah.
Sean William Scott. That's the fellow's name I'm trying to fetch for. Yeah, those are, and again, similar idea where it's not about the beauty of hockey, it's about the physicality of hockey. But yeah, Slapshot is, again, it's one of those like timeless reference points where just, it does very much speak to that sort of where hockey comes from, that sort of, the guys on the bus and the minor leagues and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of the major league of hockey movies.
But definitely Slapshot and Youngblood are the one and two you have to watch.
Yeah, Youngblood is much more about sort of the finesse, although again, even the message for that one is like, it doesn't matter if you're talented, you have to learn to fight, which is really not where hockey is anymore.
Yeah, no,
it definitely speaks to the era in which it was made. There really hasn't been a great hockey movie for quite a while. Kevin Smith at one point was going to make sort of the definitive hockey movie.
Yeah, Clerks 3, right?
No, he was going to do a series. He was going to do it as a movie, and then he was going to do it as a series for the CBC.
It was a TV show. I actually have a prop VIP or MVP. It was a TV show about hockey players.
Oh yeah,
that goalie helmet that I have in my basement, that's actually a prop from their show, because the guy who is the director of photography gave it to me. What was that show called? Yeah, I think it was called MVP. It was sort of a soap opera kind of movie, right? Or TV show.
What was the name of one?
There's another TV show, a hockey TV show, Locker Room or something like that, or.
Oh, you know what? The one that is like, if you genuinely want to get into
Rent-A-Goalie, that's the one, right?
Yeah. If you genuinely want to get into like hockey and sort of the meaning, the history, learning about it, the absolute best, the gold standard is Hockey: A People's History, which was a documentary series and that was incredible, where I can't remember how many episodes it is, but they basically did this whole series around, just sort of where the game started, where it went, the best players ever, how the game evolved, but done in this like sort of beautiful, documentary style. And that really sort of gives you the foundation for
the Hockey People.
It's a beautiful series, because it's much more grounded than, it's not like by the NHL being like, look how great we are. It's much more about just grassroots hockey in Canada and around the world, and why it matters to so many people. It's a really beautiful documentary.
Of course, there's Wayne Gretzky above and beyond too.
Well, if you want to see your hair, if you want your hair to get even higher, Jaime, watch some of the. There's a documentary about Gretzky. There's a documentary about Mario Lemieux. There's some of these players in history that were just sort of transcendent.
What about Valerie Karmilov as well? Yeah. There's lots of Gretzky movies actually, and there's a couple of Bobby Orr movies too. They're phenomenal players to watch.
The challenge with the Orr stuff is the documentary footage isn't that great, whereas with Gretzky it's better, and with Lemieux it's even better than that. Like, they're really it's the quality is the thing that suffers. You can watch old stuff, but it doesn't look great. You really never get a sense of it, whereas some of it you're like, watch the more modern stuff, you're like, holy moly, I can't believe the stuff people can do now.
Apparently
Hockey: A People's History is 10 episodes, so there you go. I don't even know if it's on any services.
I was just gonna look here, but Hockey Wives, I think, might have been that was a documentary about Hockey Wives.
Puck Bunnies.
Yeah, Puck Bunnies.
Puck Bunnies are a thing.
Paul Gross is a narrator in the People's History thing, right?
I think so.
There's actually a show about Don Cherry, too. And
I'm frantically writing all this down. Oh, I gotta get to research on
this. No, he's going to look in the show notes next week.
Oh, right.
If I get all these in there.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's in the same way that Americans romanticize baseball and football in particular.
Football, yeah.
That's the way that the Canadians romanticize hockey, about these stories. There are less of them now. Now hockey is really, it's become a bit of an elitist sport here, where it really is about having a lot of money to be able to equip and fund and do all that stuff. And that's really where it's gone in most of North America. But mm-hmm. for a long time, hockey was about, you know, kids just strapping on a pair of skates and, you know, playing on the pond until they got good enough to try out for a team and getting good enough to keep going up the ranks. And there are all these beautiful stories of, you know, little kid in the middle of nowhere who, you know, rose out of all the obscurity to become the best player on the ice. Nowadays, it's, you know, kid grew up in lap of luxury in, you know, suburbia. His parents were very wealthy and could afford to send him to the best schools. And, you know, and therefore he had all the advantages in life. And therefore he got all his, you know, his breaks. And therefore he rose mm-hmm. above.
So Hockey of People's History is on YouTube, actually, John.
Is it? Oh, that's great. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, we will recommend that one. I thought that was a really cool series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be nice if it was on Disney or something like that, right?
Yeah, or even, I imagined it would be on some sort of CBC streaming venue or
Gladiator.
Something. Yeah.
Just rolling through some of these links I found. Red Army is another one, too. That's about the Russian hockey system.
Yeah, there's a really good documentary about the 72 Summit series, too. But again, it's contextualized. It really matters more in its moment than it does, you know. It wasn't the best hockey mm-hmm. in the world. It was just about the sort of little Canada beating the big Soviets and in the height of the Cold War mm-hmm. and also their ankles.
They don't fight as much in hockey as they used to, right?
No, not really.
Yeah.
It used to be quite, used to get line brawls, you know, players all coming off the bench and fighting one another. That's far, far less common now. Now, you know, lots of face washing and sort of, you know, people sort of shoving each other around, but a lot less actual thuggery.
Yeah.
And there's been a real pushback on that stuff too, just because of the concussion stuff. And there's been a few cases of players who have had, you know, brain trauma and have had, post concussion syndrome and have had mm-hmm. long-term mental health problems and suicide problems. And so all of that sort of has become very, very muddled.
Yeah.
I honestly don't miss it. I don't miss the fighting in hockey. Obviously the thing in hockey was the idea that, you know, the referees can't see everything. So it was an opportunity for the players to police their own behavior. But now in a world where you mm-hmm. have like 40 cameras aimed at the ice and you know that players will get suspended or, you know, disciplined, like it's not as necessary as it once was. And now it just really becomes, you know, it seems like, coonery.
Yep. All right, I got a computer over here that's looking for my attention, so I got to go over there and deal with that.
Cool.
And talk
all right.
to you guys later.
So we got one more Lower Decks, no more mm-hmm. What If, and I believe there's a 1 week gap where there is no new programs coming up.
Ooh,
for a whopping one week before we start in on the next Star Trek series.
What's the next thing, Picard?
No, the next thing is Prodigy, I think.
Oh, Prodigy, okay.
Looks like the
28th is probably, so next week is the 14th and the 14th is the last Lower Decks. There's nothing on the 21st, but the 28th is Prodigy. So there's a 1 week gap there, and then Prodigy starts, it carries on for a few weeks, and then Disco starts. So and then over the course of that, then Hawkeye starts, then Book of Boba Fett starts, then Picard starts. So there's a pretty continuous stream. I think we get that one week window where there's not much going on, and then it picks right back up again.
Cool. All right.
Have a good weekend, guys.
Talk
happy
to you.
Moose Day.
Yeah, happy Moose Day.
Moose Day.
All right.
See you, bye.
He doesn't believe about us, but Moose Day. I think he thinks we're kidding.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.